In just a moment, keys to the Capitol. But first, here's the word for you sports fans. This Friday night, the cavalcade of sports takes you right to ringside at the Capitol Arena in Washington. There, you'll hear a blow-by-blow account of the night's best boxing match. Walter Cartier versus Willie Troy in the 10-round middleweight main event. Don Dunphy, veteran prize fight reporter, brings you this on-the-spot account, and you'll hear all the color and tension that accompany a main event at the Capitol Arena. Hear Cavalcade of Sports for boxing coverage at its very best every Friday night. And now, stay tuned for Keys to the Capitol on NBC.
What's going on in Washington?
Kamoi, a big problem.
A view on senatorial discipline.
The old pocketbook issue again.
Who win the election? Here's one guess.
From Washington, NBC News now brings you transcribed Keys to the Capitol, a weekly news program in which the National Broadcasting Company's top Washington reporters and commentators discuss with you the news of the week and what's behind it. Tonight you'll hear Arthur Barrio, David Brinkley, Herb Kaplow, and Leif East. NBC News has given these men the weekly assignment of going through Washington's official doors to learn the background of our national policies. We bring you now Keys to the Capitol. And first, here's NBC's Arthur Barrio.
The big question of the moment is how far will we go in helping the Chinese nationalists to defend the island of Kamoi if the Reds suddenly begin an all-out assault to take it? It's a question which probably will go unanswered unless all-out fighting starts. The administration has shown it will say nothing to tip its hand. It wants to keep the Reds guessing. So here we have a two-way guessing game. The Reds keep the nationalists guessing about any moves in the direction of Kamoi. We keep them guessing about our attitude if they do move in. Kamoi perhaps is of little military value to us, certainly not as much as Formosa itself. But as New Jersey Senator Smith pointed out this week after returning from Formosa, it might be well psychologically to keep it in nationalist hands. Also this week, you'll recall, the New York Herald Tribune said it learned the 7th Fleet had been ordered to give full logistic support to the nationalists in their defense of Kamoi. Well, theoretically, this support would mean aid short of American boys going into combat. It means supplies and materiel, but of course, who can be certain that if worse comes to worse, it would not mean manpower also. The White House has had no comment on this story. Last Sunday, there was in Denver a meeting of the National Security Council. From it came the statement that no specific decisions were advanced for action. White House spokesman referred to this statement when asked for comment on the later development. There are those, among them Senate Majority Leader Nolan, who recommend that we draw a line, somehow, somewhere, and warn the Chinese Reds that to pass over it means war. In this week's Collier's magazine, Senator Nolan points out that it's not easy to draw this so far and no farther line. He mentions places such as South Korea, Japan, Formosa. He doesn't mention Kamoi specifically, but it seems apparent that Kamoi, defensively, must be considered a part of Formosa. Nolan certainly has finished second best in his efforts to get us to sever diplomatic relations with Russia. Perhaps he'll stir up more controversy with his contention that to stop the communists, we must be willing to fight now. Well, years ago, you recall, we were warned by such military leaders as Generals Marshall and MacArthur that it would be dangerous indeed for us to permit Formosa to fall into the hands of the Reds. If life continues as it is, it would seem that a stand on our part might be inevitable. That stand might well be at Kamoi. Well, how do you gentlemen feel about it?
Well, Mr. Nolan's pretty anxious to go to war, isn't he?
I don't see how he can say that we'd take a stand on Kamoi within 1 mile of the Chinese mainland. They're certainly not going to risk the 7th Fleet in that 1 mile straight right under the batteries of the Communist Army, the artillery there.
And several of our leaders seem to have been going on record as saying that they thought that this was a bluff on the part of Communist China. One of the reasons that the Communist Chinese have so much trouble at home with disease and famine and the like. They're just trying to get the people's minds off their own troubles. Now, that may be indicative that they don't want the American people to necessarily worry at this time about the Kamoi problem as such.
Well, crossing a mile of water with an amphibious landing force is a pretty big job unless you have a big navy and a big air force, isn't it?
Well, they say the Chinese...
Sure. Do they have either? They have air
they don't have either one of them, no.
Well, they say how do they possibly do it?
The Chinese mainland right at that point is not a good jumping off point. It's mountainous and rough. There's another angle to this. Maybe perhaps the would may give the Reds a little pause of thought in there. You have about, as we get the story, about 50,000 nationalists and guerrillas. who are dug in there on Kamoi, and they say that they're dug in just about as firmly as the Japanese were entrenched at Okinawa. And it might take at least 100,000 Reds to dig them out, and they'd have to go after them man by man if they were to try any assault.
Well, how have they... see that Kamoi is anything more than a dandy little nuisance that were irritating the communists?
It's a good place to train your amphibians.
It's a wonderful place to jab the needle in them all the time. But I don't think it would make any difference. Stand other than giving some help in on a few military advisors on the ground. Give plenty of help to, so that the Nationalists could hold it, but they certainly wouldn't... Risk the Seventh Fleet on it.
That'd be one place where air power alone would be very valuable.
It'd be very valuable.
A mile of water.
Blow
those little landing ships out of the water.
But the Nationals have control of the air there.
What happened to the MiGs?
Well, at the present time, they do.
What happened to the MiGs that they had up in North Korea?
Well, by the same token, what would the Chinese communists get out of just taking Kamoi? If they wanted to go ahead and launch any sort of large-scale attack there, they might just as well go for all the marbles and go for Formosa.
Well, they might
be a lot farther away,
but
that's like going on attacking Seattle or something like that.
If you go for Kamoi, you can just blast it from the air.
They must know they can never make it. Dulles the other day, you remember, seemed so completely, utterly confident there was absolutely no chance of it. They must have...
Formosa.
Mm-hmm. That there's just no chance whatever that they could get across 90 miles of water in the face of the Seventh Fleet, particularly when they have no navy at all to speak of.
Well, it's a well-defended Formosa outpost, you might say, and of course we are pouring more and more equipment in there all the time.
Outpost of Formosa is about Hong Kong being an outpost of Formosa or Shanghai. It's really part of China.
And you wonder just what they want from it anyway. What would the Chinese communists necessarily gain?
Well, they get a little psychological.
Is it worth wasting whatever forces they have to throw into it?
I've heard a lot of conversation about the nationalist Chiang Kai-shek forces not being too anxious to fight. Has anyone heard any? How have they been doing with these little hit-and-run attacks they've had? Has there been any word on it about how effectively they have fought?
Well, the reports come out of the Chinese nationalist radio.
Of course, they're... They give themselves the benefit of any doubt.
I see also they've got sending the Midway out there with 16 destroyers, transferring that in the next 4 months, so it's obvious that we're going to stiffen up the defense on that side of the Pacific.
Let's come home for a while. Herb, I understand you've got a story there on the Watkins Committee, which is now studying the McCarthy censure testimony, so how about it, boy?
Yeah, Arnold, the Watkins Committee may have a report ready for the Senate sometime around the first week in March. We're not told yet whether the report will take the form of any specific recommendations. They have signified, of course, that the Watkins Committee will submit all the testimony it gathered in these hearings. If there are recommendations, they probably will get senatorial approval, since most senatorial committees usually are respected in whatever recommendations they make. The makeup of this Watkins Committee would only ensure such respect, for if you look around, you'll see that these six committee members are overall a middle-of-the-road group. There are no extremists. None of the members are given to rash, headline-catching statements. Well, after the report is submitted, comes the question as to when the Senate will consider such a report. And when this whole censure question arose, there were some prominent senators who said that the whole question of censure would be dealt with just as quickly as possible. And if that's so, you can just look at the map and find out that it would mean the Senate would come out of recess a few days or a week after the report is submitted. And this would be in the height of the 1954 campaign, probably sometime in the middle of October, just before the election. There are, as will be brought out in a few minutes, political ramifications to voting on censure or not censuring Joe McCarthy. Perhaps the senatorial bigwigs will decide to wait for a decision until after the election. As for the actual decision itself, one can only guess. What will the committee report? What will the Senate do? And if there is a vote of censure, what does such a vote mean? It may mean a lack of prestige, but actually would it mean the falling away of any of whatever popular support McCarthy has? That's presumably what the other 97 senators would primarily be concerned about. Censuring of McCarthy would undoubtedly be used by any political opponents, but his election is still 4 years off, and it's questionable as to just how much the folks will remember 4 years from now back there in Wisconsin. There are no tangible physical results of censure as such. What probably will figure in all this would be the post-censure conduct of the senator from Wisconsin. Would he act more in concert with his party, or would he eventually isolate himself into a party of his own? All these questions, of course, have arisen. Maybe you gentlemen have a few comments you'd like to make on it.
When did you say this report would be ready, Herb?
Well, they're making the preliminary draft sometime next week, I think. And then they expect to submit the completed report, as I understand it, first week in October.
First week in October, then, before the election, in other words.
That's right.
Well, I don't think they're going to take that thing up before the election, because as Montana Senator Murray was saying just the other day, when he left to go out and campaign, he said it'd take the cops to get him back
That's
to Washington.
Right. This may be a case where the Democrats themselves don't want to come back. After all, one of their 21 Democrats and 15 Republicans, something like that.
Besides,
most of the Democrats are in trouble. They're not going to come back, even if they don't like McCarthy.
The senators would be asking for another bit of trouble. Democrat or Republican, no matter how they'd vote on this, somebody would be mad at them, and they don't want to make anybody mad at them in the campaign time.
You're on a stump somewhere in some state or other making a speech, and your opponent is attacking you for this and that, and then up comes this McCarthy thing, and you have to come back here and take a stand on it, one way or another. Are you going to do it? Not if you can help it.
Not this year. I think that's just what everybody from Missouri about the Senate coming back to take any action on it.
Well, how are they going to avoid it, however? Because they left here more or less with a more or less implied agreement to come back before the elections. And what kind of dodge do you think they'll use?
Well, of course, two-thirds of them are not up for election.
Maybe they could have two-thirds come back.
Maybe get some of them back, the ones who aren't up for election.
No, but they're enough up for election to swing the balance one way or the other, though, among those remaining one-third.
One-third.
Yeah.
Two-thirds are enough to vote to censure or not to censure, and the other third up for election, they could say, well, I haven't had time to study the issue.
Well, if they should decide that the best thing for them to do would be to come back after election, it's the lame duck Congress, and some of the gentlemen won't be returning. I don't know how many it is actually, whether it would influence any vote. If it were a close vote, they wouldn't necessarily ponder about their political futures.
You raised some questions there, Herb. I'd like to hear someone answer if you can. One is that I've heard many times before. Suppose McCarthy is censured. What will it mean? What will it do to him? I don't think it'll do anything. What do you think?
Just a black mark on his record. That's about all that amounts to. He doesn't lose any of his privileges. He doesn't lose his chairmanship. He doesn't lose his vote. He doesn't lose his right to speak or anything else.
I don't think it'll hurt him, do you?
It's a verbal spanking, that's all.
That's all in the mouth, Tom.
I mean, the people that McCarthy's admirers, I don't think that will matter.
Well, this may, in effect, be more of a test of how the Senate itself is. The Senate itself willing to go on a record as opposed to McCarthy? So it might be more or less a challenge to the Senate rather than a challenge to McCarthy.
Well, of course, McCarthy has had a tough year of it. I mean, this coming on top of all the other things that have happened to him this year can't help but affect his political prestige.
It seems to me that this might be, if there is a vote of censure, and as we said, you can take any guess you want now, but you might consider this as more or less the marking of a period here, after which McCarthy pretty much either goes his own way or gets back in line. It's a fairly clear-cut milestone.
Well, if he is censured, obviously it will make him a good deal more careful afterward, because he's had all these things that he said in the past, all on the record, before he hasn't paid any attention to what he said. But here they come up and they take them up officially, these statements. I should think he would be a good deal more careful in the future, what he says.
Well, Herb, I
noticed he's already started being a little more careful, at least. Maybe even
well,
the other day.
During these hearings, certainly, has been at a different Joe McCarthy.
Very quiet. He and his attorney came out into the hallway and were discussing, I've forgotten what, but the attorney was saying something about another senator, and he used some adjective describing some action of the other senators, and McCarthy interrupted him and substituted another and much milder adjective. I have never seen him do anything like that before. Choose his words so carefully.
And, of course, when he was critical about a Watkins ruling that he couldn't bring up history of individual senators, in that particular case of soliciting that classified material, McCarthy said it was an unwise decision, but he said Watkins was acting in good faith. He clearly made that point. Apparently he does. Just doesn't want to. He may not win out, but he doesn't want to antagonize anybody in more than
that. That's tough committed to antagonize because it's all standing together. It's a highly disciplined little committee there. The Watkins wheels the gavel, and the other five members stand right behind him solidly. When the questioning is on, it's a committee counsel who does the questioning, and nobody else makes any speeches or jumps in and tries to grab a headline. If he's got one question he wants answered, he asks that, and then there's no individual grandstand play among these senators. They stand very tight.
They've been a tightly run little group. They've been very well disciplined.
I was going to say, I think you said, Herb, in effect, that voters perhaps 4 years from now will forget what has gone on. But I've been wondering if, with the record having been developed the way it has in this particular hearing, if 4 years from now the record might not be resurrected out there in Wisconsin, and that this essential proceedings might just be harmful in Senator McCarthy's campaign for re-election.
Well, undoubtedly it will be brought up as he runs for dog catcher anyway on this whole thing, but... Of course, the situation could change, and there are any number of things that could happen in the 4 years left for Senator McCarthy in the Senate.
Last time a senator was censured, he was defeated the next election, wasn't he? Mm-hmm. Hiram Bingham.
I think he retired. He ended his political
career. We can get into the political ramifications of this very easily, I think, by moving a leaf now. Don't you have some topic there?
I have something about issues. You know, every time I hear somebody talking about issues, it reminds me of Mr. Dooley's saying about political platforms. Mr. Dooley says that there's only one platform for the outs, and that platform is, look at the horrible mess we're in. And the platform for the ins is, it'll be worse for the other fellas. Well, it's a long time ago that he said that, but they're still using the same...
Like a railroad platform, it's something to get in on.
something not to stand on, but to run on. I'd say they're still using the same platforms. They seem to wear like iron. And as for the issues, why, most of those are pretty familiar, too. Some real old-timers, like taxes and public power and the farm problem and even the high cost of living. But for a change, we've got some pretty definite party stands on some of these issues. The Republicans have put through their flexible farm price support. The Democrats as a party are for the old 90% variety. The Republicans have passed their business incentive tax bill. The Democrats put themselves on record in favor of raising everybody's tax exemption. And they squared away pretty much on atomic power, too. So for a change, we haven't got a lot of synthetic issues this year. It doesn't look right now as if communism and Joe McCarthy are going to be the big issues that we thought they'd be a few months back. Things have happened. There is another issue, or maybe you'd call it an influence. And that is a split in the Republican Party. A main election this week produced some evidence of that. And in New Jersey, the Taft and pro-McCarthy wing of the party is actually organized against the party's own candidate for the Senate, Cliff Case. And I'm wondering whether the results in Maine won't bring a further shift among some Republicans who've never been too happy anyway with some parts of the Eisenhower program. Whether they won't strike out more on their own and play down the dynamic progressive program, particularly in the Middle West. There's one thing we've got to remember about these off-year congressional elections, and that is that your candidate is out there running pretty much on his own, the way that he figures will appeal to the men and women of his particular constituency. And if he talks about national issues at all, they're national issues that mean something in the local area. These off-year congressional campaigns are sort of guerrilla fights. They're fought all over the country. And sometimes a new federal building or a post office or a reclamation project is likely to be a lot bigger issue in some places than atomic energy. I may be wrong about this, but it seems to me that one issue is going to be predominant this year, the economic issue, in a dozen different forms. Jobs, prices down on the farm, prosperity, recession. You know, that whole general economic subject broken down to fit every voting group's interest. The closer we get to November, the more I think so. It's the old pocketbook issue. What do you think about that, huh?
Well, you know, today, Vice President Nixon and Speaker Martin were hosted a little breakfast they had out at the airport. It's something new. They had
men of press, radio, and television out there at 8:30 this morning to serve them scrambled eggs and ham and what have you. And
they have you out there that early?
They didn't get me that early.
I wondered about
that. But at any rate, then, after the breakfast, Martin and Nixon flew off to other parts of the campaign throughout the country. Nixon said in his little speech out there that, as far as he sees it, there are no big issues. But naturally, that's the Republican contention. But he said that there are no big issues for the Democrats to campaign on. But he did believe that the results in Maine make it evident that the GOP will have to work harder than ever this year. I don't think they're taking anything for granted. As they say, they are running scared. I think they're the first to admit it.
Well,
big issues or not.
That all sounds as if the campaign has been called off. Today, Nixon tells us there are no issues. Yesterday they both signed an agreement not to throw any dirt at each other, so what are we going to do this fall?
How suspend the government?
We have no issues, and we can't deal in personalities. So what can we do?
Well, I don't know whether the issues have to be big necessarily to come out on top or come out on bottom. In some parts of the country, it only takes one issue. Out in the Midwest, I was out there rather recently, and they were satisfied to be, well, some of the people were discontent on one issue alone. They didn't like the farm situation.
Yeah, most people can get mad
at that
one.
That was a pretty good topic.
You don't have to be mad at a lot of subjects.
Couldn't get into the grain elevators and couldn't get their money for their crops. And they weren't interested in looking at atomic energy.
That's what I was pointing out. That the only national issues that are going to be brought up by the various candidates are the ones that pinpoint in his own district. He's not going to bother about the foreign trade policy if he's running in Iowa.
And I've never seen in an election year where, particularly in this farm area, where strong Republicans are scooting away from the party and get back in the hometown, hop up on the platform and tell them they're for rigid support.
Speaking of needing only one issue, I used to know a man who voted against Roosevelt consistently. He was in office 13 years and there were thousands of actions and pieces of legislation and so forth he was responsible for. This man voted against him time after time because one time he made a remark, well, it's only money. He didn't like that. That was reason enough for him to vote against Roosevelt in spite of everything else he did that might have been good or bad. That one little thing is all he needed. Well, you can stir up an issue if you really look for it.
If you look a little farther past this thing anyway, when the Republicans first took over a couple of years ago, you couldn't tell the parties without a program, it seemed, because as soon as you had a responsibility, they started to talk sort of like the Democrats in a lot of matters, and then the Democrats started to sound like Republicans, and the idea of cutting taxes and pretty much often boils down to who's carrying the ball on a particular issue.
I would guess that it'd be awfully hard to stir up any excitement with an issue like Dixon Yates. To get up on a platform and start talking about Dixon Yates.
He might do it in Tennessee.
In Tennessee, maybe, and West Arkansas. But where else?
The average fellow doesn't understand it. I don't think he cares much about trying to understand it.
Issues are only leading up to one thing, and that's who's going to win the election. Everybody wants to know that.
Well,
Dave, what about it?
Well, for those people who want to know who's going to win the election, here I am. Just listen. I'll take a minute or two here. Leaf has spelled out the issue. I will make so bold as to try to guess what the election results are going to be. And
you remember 48?
Sure I do. Of course I do. But if these guesses turn out to be right, I'll come back here and remind all of you about how smart I was.
And if you're wrong,
if they're wrong, I'll just forget it. We've all forgotten 48, haven't we? I have. I can't even remember it when I try.
Save the script anyhow.
I believe the Republicans are going to lose a considerable number of the votes they got in 1952. I think they will lose control of the House. And in the Senate, if they don't lose it entirely, the majority will be just about as slim and shaky as it is right now, which is about as slim and shaky as you can get. What do they have, a majority of one?
One.
Mm-hmm. Here's why I think that. First, of course, as everyone knows, the old historical fact that in off-year, non-presidential year elections, like this one, the party in power practically always loses. I think 1934 is the only time that didn't work. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
That's Roosevelt's second year in office. The party in power doesn't have the added interest and excitement of a contest for the presidency, and it doesn't have the help of a strong personality running for office. In this case, it would be Eisenhower. So the vote usually, or almost always, is smaller. And when the vote is smaller, you're likely to get a greater proportion of voters who are dissatisfied. And for some perverse reason, people are more likely to go out and vote against something than to go out and vote for something. So the result almost always is that the party in power gets a lot of voters who are against it and usually loses. And another reason, I'd like to hear some other opinions on this too. Another reason I expect some Republican losses is that 2 years ago we had a change of administration for the first time in 20 years. That's millions of people not old enough to remember the last time we had a Republican in the White House. So to a very great extent, all of the faults of the government were thought to be Democratic Party faults. And when we changed to a Republican administration, I think people expected too much. Too many people thought high taxes were a disease exclusively of Democrats, that government deficits and government debts were the property of Democrats, and that big government and interference in our lives and our businesses, red tape, all the things that make people mad. Too many of us thought that with Republicans in office, all this would change. And, of course, it has not. There have been some improvements here and there of a more or less minor nature, but we still have high taxes. The government is still going into debt. We still have the communist threat to the peace, which a great many people blamed on the Democrats. So, again, I think too many people expected too much and therefore disappointed. I don't mean to be running the Republicans down. Their record in Congress generally is pretty good. But they have not made any great, bold, radical improvements that was likely to sweep the voters off their feet. It just isn't possible to do that. But I think a lot of people, rightly or wrongly, expected more, and maybe they were led to expect more, and they haven't got it. So for those reasons and some others, I think the Republicans in this fall's elections will lose some ground. I think they will lose the House, possibly the Senate. Who has another idea? Leif, you agree with that?
No, I would guess it. If I were going to guess, I would guess that way. But then probably the Democrats will get 30 seats they run in the House, pick them up from the Republicans, and that'll give them a sizable majority there.
Well, do you think a lot of people are disappointed? Huh? You think a lot of people are disappointed?
I think a lot of people are bound to be disappointed with any administration. It's not this one particularly, but they did expect too much of it.
There's also the added factor that in the last election there was a large departure from traditional voting. For instance, the Democrats will tell you now that they can't lose anything in the Midwest because they don't have anything. They lost in the South in 1952, and they figure that that was just sort of a freak year, and they'll get it back. So they figure
they
can't lose.
The trend is back to the party in the South. There's no doubt about that, because Shivers had quite a Shivers scared on them.
Mr. Stevenson made a very significant visit to Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, when someone is running for office, a new man whose record you don't know much about, you're very inclined to think that he is the kind of... that his politics is like yours. How do you like that grammar?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Pretty good.
Yours.
Yeah. You're likely to think his politics is like yours. I'm going to say it again. And when he gets in office, you find out he's not. They're not, necessarily. You'll disagree with him on some things, and you'll be disappointed. He goes in with the idea that he is all things to all men, and of course he's not.
The moment you start making an appointment or a decision, you start losing votes.
Every decision you make makes somebody or other man.
Mm-hmm.
Decide against sin. That's about the only one you can.
Or the man-eating shark.
Man-eating shark and a repetition of the Chicago fire. That's about the only thing you can be against.
You have been listening to Keys to the Capitol, brought to you transcribed by NBC News as a way of taking you behind the doors of official Washington with NBC's top reporters and commentators. Tonight you have heard David Brinkley, Arthur Berrio, Lee Feed, and Herb Kaplow. Keys to the Capitol will be brought to you at the same time next week. This is the NBC Radio Network.